The news and opinions expressed on Occupy Radio may not necessarily reflect the views of KWVA Eugene, the University of Oregon, or the Associated Students of the University of Oregon.
From KWVA in Eugene
and the Occupy Eugene Media Group, this is Occupy Radio, an extended conversation about the issues which gave rise to the Occupy movement. I'm your host, David Getchy, Sierra Lupe.
Odds are there's only going to be one network that's built out to many rural areas. And if that network is subsidized by the federal government and owned by AT&T or by some other large company like CenturyLink or Frontier, we know that those people are going to have very poor service forever, and it's probably going to have to be subsidized forever. And so it's incredibly important to find alternate ownership structures like rural electric co-ops that have so long served their communities and do such a better job on average than the big private companies.
Ready, set, get local net. Christopher Mitchell joins us on Occupy Radio this week to talk about the hundreds of community broadband networks that are providing some of the best internet service in the country. Also, Jerry Monroe Maynard addresses the recent fire at a Houston, Texas Islamic school and how faiths are called to challenge fear and hatred with courageous love.
Howdy, Occupiers, and welcome to Occupy Radio. I'm David Getchy, Sierra Lupe, but you can all call me Getch. I'm here in Eugene, Oregon, and I'm speaking with my wonderful co-host, Rivera Sun, over there in Taos, New Mexico. And you've been in town for a while now, Rivera. No gallivanting all over the country for you this week, huh?
No, I did go on a side trip up to the cradle of the nuclear bomb, which is Los Alamos. We have been working on nuclear issues here in our local community because nuclear weapons are local to us, unfortunately. Mm. But besides that, I have stayed home, particularly the last 2 days, where we have gotten a wonderful snowfall, about 6 inches as I'm looking outside the window, which was kind of a surprise since it was feeling like spring 3 days ago.
That's happening all over the Pacific Northwest here. We have a very spring-like winter. Flowers are blooming. I just hope we don't get a freeze in March to shoot it all backwards.
Yeah, I'm glad we got our snow now because the trees hadn't budded out yet. Now, our listeners will get cozy with us today because you haven't gotten that chance in a few weeks. We've been rushing right through this introduction section to get to our guests who have been fascinating, and we've spent a lot of time with them. But today we have some other news that we want to bring your attention to, one of which is an update on the Apache copper mine that we had reported had gone through Congress as part of the National Defense Authorization Act, just kind of tacked on to that bill. And I just want to let listeners know that the Apache have occupied the mine for the proposed mine site for 2 weeks now, and they're vowing not to leave until they get this land, which is considered sacred to them, out of the hands of, I believe it's an Australian copper mining company.
I think it's Australian and British are the two international forces moving into Native American land given away by the Americans in violation of a treaty.
That's right. And, you know, there's a wonderful article up on popularresistance.org about this, and it really just shows photos of the occupation and the tribal people, just their commitment to keeping what will become a 2-mile-wide hole in this area. We're not talking about a little mine either, not just like a hole into the ground. This is an open pit copper mine, which, you know, copper is actually not that safe for us to be around in the mining process. And the Forest Service, actually, which is the people who are on the ground from the U.S. government who have to deal with the occupation, is apparently being quite sympathetic to the Apaches' protest and their outrage, and also to the concerns about the environment that the Apache are raising. And I just find it a really fascinating story. And one other element of it is that we're seeing intertribal solidarity. So many tribes saying that we will come and occupy with the Apache, we will come and resist this mine with the Apache. And this has a long legacy in the U.S. and it's we should be aware of it as non-Indigenous activists in the United States, that there is this increasingly fertile and healthy intertribal relationship to resist another assault of the colonizing American empire.
You know, I'm going to have to get in touch with Lauren Regan of the CLDC, the Civil Liberties Defense Center. She often defends activists in these type of situations. I wonder if she is out there defending Apaches right now.
I don't know. We'll have to find out. There's been no arrests yet. They actually are legally allowed to occupy the space right now. They won't apparently they won't try to kick them out until week four or until the mine is actually under development.
Rivera, though? I just want to jump in there. It's just really ironic that we're saying that they are legally entitled to occupy their own land.
That is a thank you for catching my language on that. You know, they have every right to be there. We have no right to be there. And we didn't have much of a right to swap that land, is what they call it, the land swap, and give it to the foreign copper mining companies.
Yeah. Now, you said that things in Taos, though, right now are in the world where right now I saw a stat the other day that says that 3 people per day in 2015 have been killed by the police in the United States. So that's 1 person every 8 hours. But apparently over in Taos, things are going a little bit better.
Yeah, you know, our police department has taken the opposite of the Ferguson model and the NYPD model, and looking at the increasing animosity growing between citizens and the police, mostly for very justifiable reasons, they decided that they needed to sit down with the community, and they held a series of meetings with our community, with our nonprofits, with our church groups, with our our justice organizations, and with just the general public, to see what we want to see out of our police department. And these conversations were not always easy. Sometimes they got very heated and contentious, but they were very productive.
And they didn't beat anybody up in those meetings.
No one was beat up or shot. Nobody was arrested.
Boy, that's heartwarming.
Yeah, you know, it's not a perfect process, but I was very heartened to see them attempting to go a different route, go more of a community policing model, and to engage the community in saying, what do you want from us?
Now, that in contrast with Pasco, Washington, where Antonio Zambrano Montez was gunned down for throwing rocks in front of it was an amazing scene. I mean, it was a stoplight full of traffic, 3 cops just firing their guns all over the place, right in the middle of this busy intersection, chasing Antonio down. Antonio was running away from them with his hands in the air, and he stopped, and it's very clear on the video. He stops, he turns around, his hands are in the air, they're not threatening anybody, and he starts to go down to his knees, which, what do you think is going on when somebody does that?
That surrender, you know, it's also so evocative of the protests in Ferguson, where they did get down on their knees with their hands up, and the police just fired on him.
Yes, yes. And now Pasco is unfortunately the latest in a string of cities with ongoing protests against police brutality. And this one is happening somewhat in the dark. I mean, people know about Pasco, but it's not like Ferguson. It's not like Eric Garner in New York City. That this is there is strong public anger over the Zambrano shooting, but we're not seeing it. We're not hearing about it as much. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if maybe our police forces have learned their lesson because they didn't bring out any military hardware to put this protest down. Maybe they're learning a lesson.
I think they probably are. And, you know, that means that our movements have to adapt and change. And also, you know, it's quite likely that we are actually winning this struggle. Even though, you know, lives are being lost every single day, this is a struggle that Obama said we should have patience with. I think how much patience do we need to have when it's risking people's lives? And it is the time, it is the moment, it's part of the zeitgeist of the time. And, you know, I think the more attention we as alternative journalists can give to this, the more strength and support we can give to the movements that are calling for some real justice in this country.
And one of the ways that we can get the word out is by exercising our freedom of speech on the internet, which is what, to some degree, we're talking about today. We're talking about the ability for communities to build their own broadband infrastructure, even though the large cable and internet providers are writing laws in 19 states to stop that from happening. So we're going to talk with Christopher Mitchell today, and he's going to give us the scoop on community broadband. We're talking today with Christopher Mitchell. He's the Director of Community Broadband Networks for the Institute of Local Self-Reliance out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And he's one of our own. He's the host of the podcast Community Broadband Bits. So, Christopher, welcome to Occupy Radio. And we're going to talk about net neutrality and community broadband. And this is a very timely conversation with the FCC decision coming up. So welcome to Occupy Radio.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on another podcast.
Now, before we dive into the fascinating subject of what, you know, influence the FCC has over your arena of work, let's start with just catching our listeners up to speed about what community broadband networks are and what is the work that you do with them.
I think that's a really good question. The term community broadband networks is something I think of as an umbrella term that refers to many different ways in which a community can have a network that responds to its needs rather than just the needs of a massive corporation that really doesn't have the same interests as the community. So if you're in a community and you want to have great broadband internet, I would argue that you should look at one of three models. Municipal ownership, where the local government owns it, or cooperative ownership would be the second model. That's more common in rural areas outside of towns. And then the third is, in some ways, a hybrid, which is a nonprofit type approach, where the board of the nonprofit may be representing local people who have an interest in making sure that there's a great service available. Now, I think what we'll probably focus on today is municipal ownership and municipal networks, which are a form of community networks. And that's where the city itself owns and sometimes operates, but not always, a network, often in competition with a cable or telephone company.
And right now, we're all very excited about the FCC choosing to list the internet basically as a common carrier and removing a lot of the potential for our corporate internet connectors to bleed us dry, which is a nice thing. But the next battle, it seems to me, is in the community broadband arena because of the fact that so many states, I guess it's 19 states right now, is that it, that have made it illegal for all of those things that you just described, Christopher, the local community and nonprofits and whatnot, to go ahead and wire themselves up to the internet?
Well, what I often say is that there's about 20 states that have created barriers. In some, it's a prohibition, like you say. In other ones, there's it's just more of a hindrance and a discouragement, but you can still find ways through it. And most of those barriers are directed toward the outright municipal ownership. In almost every place, you can form a new cooperative. It's just that the challenges of forming a new cooperative are so great that municipal approaches tend to be the most feasible in most locations.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Boulder, Colorado as an example of this, because they're a little bit interesting, as I understand it, and I'm hoping you'll help me understand this better. They actually have decided to do a community network project that actually flies in the face of the state laws. Is that right?
Yes. Colorado has an odd situation where they, in 2005, the company that was then called Quest, which is now CenturyLink, that's a big telephone company, the third biggest telephone company in the United States, they pushed through this law in Colorado that made it basically impossible for local governments to offer to do any telecommunications service provisioning unless they had a referendum. And if you have a referendum, then you essentially free yourself from the restrictions. And that's what Boulder has done, along with more than 10 other communities in Colorado at this point.
So they get to override state laws and say, no, we really do want to provide ourselves with a community broadband. But does the state then have more roadblocks that they have to overcome?
Not in Colorado, no. In other places, there are roadblocks even after a referendum. But Colorado's kind of nice in that regard. It's definitely an annoyance that a community has to go through that. But communities that went through that just recently over the course of the last year had a real benefit, because this terrible Comcast merger with Time Warner Cable is sitting in front of the Federal Communications Commission. And while Comcast has a pending merger, they're not engaging in the dirty tactics that they often have in the past. So when Boulder had its referendum in the past fall, they didn't have a massive campaign from Comcast that was trying to confuse people. So it was an interesting time where a lot of communities in Colorado have taken advantage of Comcast not wanting to embarrass itself, and they're having these referendums now.
Wow. So of the other 32, so 20 states have barriers, as we pointed out. Of the other 32 states, how many of those have municipal broadband or community broadband networks going? Or what percentage of all the potential community networks that are out there are actually using their capacity to do community networks?
Well, there's a lot of different approaches, even within just the municipal approaches. So we're tracking about 450 local governments where they've done some sort of action to build a network or make some sort of connectivity available in at least some part of town. There's about 150 places across the United States where you could actually get service anywhere within town from a local government. And of those 150, there's about half of those are older cable networks that were built more than 10 or 15 years ago. And then about half of them are more modern fiber-to-the-home networks, which tend to be the fastest available capacities, you know, the places where you can actually get the best connectivity in the country. We have these different approaches. And outside of the 150 that are available citywide, in most cases, you don't really have access as a resident, but there may be access to local businesses as a way of trying to make sure that those businesses can stay in town and do well, rather than having to move to a different town where they have a better option.
And all of these places where we're getting the fiber link, they deliver faster speeds than anything that Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, et cetera, can deliver?
Not always, but in many cases. Some of these ones that were built 10 or more years ago, they may have used a technology that that doesn't allow for the same fast speeds that Comcast does currently. However, in most cases, the community does offer higher speeds. And in every case that I'm aware of, even if like Comcast might advertise higher speeds, you could work with the local government to find a way of getting yourself connected with higher speeds. But there might be a one-time cost involved or something like that. So, you know, it's not, this is a this sort of, in some ways, is a moving target here. You know, if you built a network in in the year 2002, because you had no cable or DSL broadband internet available, then at that time you were the only one providing it. But since then, a Comcast might have come in and offered a slightly superior service. And, you know, in coming years, you may upgrade your existing service so that there and again, you're much faster than the Comcast service. But it's important to note that communities often invest in these networks not just to have the fastest speeds, but to have really good customer service or to offer an option so that more money will stay in the community, you know, rather than being sent out to Comcast shareholders. And one thing that we do see very often is that even if Comcast offers a better service than what the municipality does, often you're paying less for that service to Comcast than you would in a town that doesn't have a municipal network. So, you know, I'm wary of suggesting that all municipalities are always better. In the long run, I think that they are, and in most cases they are. But there are some exceptions where temporarily a cable company may have slightly faster services.
So it seems to me right about the time you're talking about, 2002, 2001, the community outside of Eugene, where I live here in Oregon, ran fiber optic cable out into the country and everything as well. And has any is fiber optic still considered the state of the art in terms of data delivery?
Yes. Yeah, there's nothing better than fiber optics, although there's various flavors of fiber optics, you might say. But in general, and if you think of like our research universities, which are developing the next cutting edge ways of transmitting information, they're all working at how to improve the capacity of fiber optics rather than something that would replace fiber optics.
So fiber optics is probably still the future.
Yes, and it's hard to imagine a time when it won't be. And networks that are built in a smart way, to build a fiber optic network is very expensive, and so I think that's one of the concerns people often have. But if you do it correctly, then even if something was to come along and replace fiber optics, let's say in 15 years, some better medium comes along, like a carbon nanotube fiber rather than a glass fiber, then what you would do is you'd actually replace the existing fiber by just pulling it through the conduits underground rather than having to dig a whole new trench and everything. So this isn't something that we would expect, even if there's a significant disruption in the technology. We wouldn't expect the high cost of replacing it to be the high cost of creating it that we currently experience.
Well, that's good news. And it's really kind of interesting because I live in Taos, New Mexico, which is an extremely rural area where, you know, we actually do have our local electric utility has a broadband subdivision, and they're putting in fiber optic all over the place here, which is kind of remarkable for a state that is only 1.5 million people to be investing in getting fiber optic to people, not only to what we traditionally think of, but also some of the pueblos are involved in this too. But here's part of my question is, when you look at all these municipal networks that are all over the place, what percentage of them are happening in urban centers and what percentage are happening in rural areas?
Well, I think to some extent, it depends on the definition of rural. And for the most part, we see that even in rural areas, these networks tend to happen in areas that have a slightly higher density. So, for instance, there's a community southwest of Minneapolis here called Sibley County, and it's a heavily farming county. And they're looking at how they can connect just about everyone. But they're starting in the seven towns. And, you know, those towns, some of them may only have a few hundred people or even 1,000 people. But that's where they tend to start, and then they can expand out a bit. Now, when it comes to municipal networks, the vast majority of them are in towns of less than 50,000 people. It's only in recent years that we've really seen larger towns considering this. And that's because, you know, 10 years ago, when broadband was basically just DSL or cable and very few were doing fiber optics, well, all the big towns already had a big cable provider, and so it wasn't as much of an incentive. But now when you see towns that are large cities that are worried about their ability to compete, to have a high quality of life, or just being annoyed at the fact that Time Warner Cable raises your rates every year, then now they're starting to look at these strategies to figure out what they can do, and so that's just not something we'd seen 10 years ago.
Wow, that is really fascinating. And it's really interesting, having grown up in rural regions and living in one now, I don't think people really, really understand the impact of internet connection on rural communities and how important I see it as, and the shift to especially online education is so profound in people's lives out here on the prairie, so to speak. But I think, it's very heartening for me to hear that these municipal networks are mostly in cities that are smaller and towns that are very small. It's very beautiful thing. It reminds me of the early days of the labor movement, when you saw the organization of the new society actually happening in the rural regions. So I think that's very interesting and exciting. Let's talk a little bit about... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think you're right. I think it's incredibly exciting in rural areas, and I think it's incredibly important, because odds are there's only going to be one network that's built out to many rural areas. And if that network is subsidized by the federal government and owned by AT&T or by some other large company like CenturyLink or Frontier, we know that those people are going to have very poor service forever. And it's probably going to have to be subsidized forever. And so it's incredibly important to find alternate ownership structures like rural electric co-ops that have so long served their communities and do such a better job on average than the big private companies. So this is, in some ways, this isn't just a matter of saying, oh, this is something that's interesting. Like, we have a window of opportunity to permanently solve a problem in an efficient manner. And that's where I hope that people understand that they need to take action right now.
Now, how is it that communities can use existing electrical infrastructure? Because you're still needing to run new cable, right?
Right. And when I said rural electrics, I just meant as an example of a good approach. When we decided to electrify the rural areas, we did it by building cooperatives that represented local interests rather than just shoveling a bunch of money at private companies. And that's the organizing these local cooperatives is incredibly effective and very financially or fiscally responsible. If you look at like southern Missouri, where Como, a rural electric cooperative, exists, they're building out, and they do have to build all new wires, but they have an experience of working within these communities. They have a relationship. And so, I think a rural electric cooperative expanding into fiber is still a high cost involved, but it's a much better approach than having, the existing telephone company just get a bunch more subsidies to continue providing poor service if that's what they've been doing historically.
And didn't the existing providers just get billions of dollars? I looked at the report out from the White House, and it seemed to me there was more than $10 billion pumped into the broadband providers that did not turn into improvements in service.
Well, there's a number of different ways in which we've historically given away a ton of public dollars to private companies in this for very little return. And so I don't know offhand which one you're talking about, but others have estimated that when you look at all the ways in which we've allowed private companies to increase their cost to consumers in return for a promise to build better networks, it's been on the order of $300 billion and more. And in many ways, they've just taken that money and given it to shareholders or executives in compensation rather than actually investing in the way that they promised they would. And our local and our state governments have not done a good job of policing them to enforce the promises that they've made.
I think another element of, the cost-benefit analysis of any local, particularly cooperative businesses or municipally run businesses, is that we often don't examine the flow of our money very carefully. When you have a community broadband network, you are running your own community's network. And it's the difference between sending, I don't know what other people's rates are, but, you know, $20 to $60 to $100 a month to Comcast for your service versus to your local electric utility, which, as you pointed out, Christopher, have a better track record of fiscal responsibility. And they also tend to have a better circulation of those dollars into their local community, which, again, does nothing but good for the local community. So I think those are important elements to keep in mind. Let's talk a little bit about this upcoming FCC ruling that we are all keeping our fingers crossed and our hearts and heads in action and motion about. The ruling to reclassify the internet as a Title II carrier. Why don't you talk a little bit about what the impacts of that decision are on the community broadband networks?
Well, the impacts on community broadband networks are actually incredibly small. The FCC is basically, as people know who have followed net neutrality, the FCC is looking at a way of changing the way the rules have been written in order to maintain the way the network has worked. when you look at how AT&T and Comcast have at different times suggested they would like to cut special deals, create fast lanes, and other things, a lot of people became worried and wanted to make sure that the internet would continue to work in the way it historically has, where effectively pretty much everyone has some form of equal access to spread information. And so the FCC is going to change the way the network is regulated in order to ensure that it operates in that same manner. And I don't think it really will impact unions. The local governments haven't had an incentive to try to charge one provider more than another provider. If you think about, there's never been an incentive for the municipal government to say, if you're going to go to MSNBC, we're going to charge you more than if you go to CNN or something like that. So these sort of rules, I don't think, will impact it. Municipalities already are transparent for the most part. They have methods of resolving complaints. And I think that all of this excitement around Title II is justified, but we're not going to see major changes because the goal of the rules change is just to keep things as they've always been.
And also, isn't one of the points that the rules change is going to have a bigger impact on unwired internet? Isn't that the case?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I'm not as familiar with all the wireless aspects, so I tend not to bring it up as much. But the wired networks have historically had some form of protection, or at least some expected protection, and wireless had been exempted, and now that's going to be extended to wireless as well. So that may change the way some people's phones work in terms of, congestion issues and that sort of thing. But in general, I think most people aren't going to see that big of a difference. And the big benefit is that we'll know now if a company is doing anything to interfere with your traffic, they have to tell you. And if it's unreasonable what they're doing, then you'll have the right to complain about it. And that's the big change.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when we're looking at the other end of the proposal spectrum that was being proposed by Comcast and the other big carriers, corporate carriers, they had a whole slew of proposals and desires about making tiered access that would have really impacted our lives. And so, we're looking at kind of a big specter, a big monster. And the reclassification is a way of getting us out of that nightmare situation. But it's kind of reassuring to know that, municipal networks actually have a little bit of protection in place in just the way that they're organized and designed for all of those kind of shenanigans. Once again, going local means that not always, but quite often, there's a little bit more justice for the people in that situation. So what...
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Can I actually just follow up on that? Because I think this is the key point, right? Is that it's not so much that municipalities have to be better. I think in almost every case they are. But one of the benefits is just diffusing power. So, you know, if Comcast wants to do something terrible, that impacts 20 million people. And whereas if, you know, if some small town decides that it's going to try to charge Netflix more, then that impacts very few people. And the result is that that small town can't really do it because Netflix isn't going to bend over backwards to meet the extortion demands of a small network. It also means that if one network decides to do something terrible, the regulator can crack down on it. Whereas a regulator trying to crack down on Comcast finds that, you know, the regulator's boss gets a lot of money from Comcast, mm-hmm. and Comcast owns, you know, hundreds of lobbyists in D.C. and the regulators themselves either worked for Comcast in the past or expect to work for Comcast in the future. And so just by having hundreds or thousands of networks rather than one or two networks, we have better outcomes.
That is such a good point, and I'm so glad that you made that really clear to our listeners. I think our listeners will remember when Richard Wolff was on the show talking about economics and democracies and how we think we live in a political democracy, and it's a principle that we share, we believe that we should, for the most part. But every day we go to work and we walk into a dictatorship. And every day, many of us turn on our computers and we log onto the internet and we're logging into a dictatorship, more or less. So what Christopher is bringing up is so key for our minds to get around and really think, what kind of a world do we want to live in our business and in our services that we're provided? Do we want to live in mini dictatorships all over the place? Or do we want to see more democratic structures that are more responsive to our wants, needs, and desires, that have decentralized control, which means more local input and control, more diversity, and more looking at different options rather than the homogenous monoliths that we're faced with right now. So, Christopher, here's a question. What are some of the projects that are looming that are most exciting to you that are in development? Like, if everyone could turn their eyes on a couple of examples, what are the ones that you're most excited about right now?
Well, what I tend to be really excited about are networks where the city is finding a way of building either passive or open infrastructure, which means that the local government is not just replicating the cable monopoly model. I think there's a little bit of danger. I think if you look at places like Chattanooga, which is so often referenced, they do a lot of things really well, but the best scenario, I think, is a situation where the local government is finding ways to allow anyone to become a service provider and to allow niches to develop. Providing a very great internet access is something that we've seen a lot of local governments are able to do. But over time, the goal is, in my mind, to have many different service providers so that our networks would operate like roads. They'd be owned by the local government. They'd have to be responsive to public needs. They'd be available to all on an equal basis. And anyone would be able to use them. So, you know, you can use them to start a co-op and to do whatever commerce you'd like. You can use them for personal uses. And there's some reasonable approach. Almost all the municipalities have really gone with a kind of approach which is more or less similar to what industry has done. But over time, I'm hoping to see more communities where they find ways of opening it up. And so one good example right now is Westminster, Maryland, where they're building this fiber network, and they're working with a company that has a terrific reputation called Ting that is going to provide service and help others to provide services as well. And that's one that I encourage people to take a look at.
Now, one of the big issues I wanted to talk about is the potential to turn back some of the legislation which is holding community broadband hostage. And I noticed in the report, I guess, that I can't remember the title of the report that Obama released recently, he is hoping, he's putting pressure, I guess, on the FCC to use its power to open up some of those networks that have been shut down by legislation. Do you know where that's going? What's the possibility for massively turning that all around, all 20 states, massively turning them all around?
I don't think we have a real prospect for turning them all around at once. But next week, when the FCC votes on the net neutrality issues, they're also voting on a separate issue, which will be to turn around those laws in North Carolina and Tennessee. So we're going to reverse it in two states, and that will, first of all, result in an appeal. The industry will certainly try to have that reversed in the courts. But it will allow other states to petition as well. You know, I think this is something that's going to be a multi-year process to be able to ensure that communities all have the ability to offer these networks. But Senator Cory Booker is leading an effort in Congress to reestablish local authority everywhere. It's the law of the land. And, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. But one of the things that people need to do, and I think it doesn't really feel empowering, but people really do need to write a few letters and contact our elected officials to say, hey, I'm not being well served. I'm really sick of how my cable company treats me. I want more options. What are you going to do about it? Because the cable lobbyists, they talk to these elected officials all the time. And the telephone lobbyists are telling everyone, you know, hey, we're doing a great job. Everyone's happy. And so unless people speak out, their elected officials aren't going to make this a priority. And I do think that there's a lot of things that can be done on the local level. But we need to make sure that the states and the federal government don't get in our way as we're doing them.
And the level of service we're getting is internationally poor. Isn't that the case?
Right. It depends on where you are. But for the most part, yeah, we tend to pay way too much for far too slow service. You know, in many cases, there's unreliable services. And so when you look at how other advanced cities or even in rural areas in many places are served, they often have better services. Now, I'd say that some of the best services in the country are available in the U.S. in a few places, often rural areas that have built their own networks. But in general, the cable and telephone companies provide services here that do not compare well to our peers internationally.
Which is kind of ironic because some of these companies are working internationally and being forced by regulations in other countries to provide better service. This conversation could take up a whole new episode of Occupy Radio, maybe Occupy Radio International someday. But Christopher Mitchell is the director of the Community Broadband Networks for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, which is based out of Minneapolis. He is also the host of the Community Broadband Bits podcast. So if you want to go into these conversations really in depth in little short segments, I recommend that podcast. Christopher, we just have a minute or so left on the show. And once again, you have helped our listeners remember that as big as the problems are, the solutions are also much more practical, tangible, here and real than we often think about. So what is something that you would like our listeners to go off considering at the end of the show today?
Well, I think everyone should look at what they can do. Local governments can do a lot of things to expand access. And I think without being pressured by their constituents, they're not going to. So, you know, people need to talk to each other and figure out, you know, what would be an option in our town. You know, we have a toolkit available at muninetworks.org and encourage people to inform themselves and then to form committees and think about it and pressure their elected officials to take action.
Yeah, I'm behind you 100% on that, Chris. And we probably do want to get back together on this topic on a future date. But in the meantime, thanks for coming on Occupy Radio.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're listening to Occupy Radio with Rivera and Getch, syndicated across the nation on the Pacifica Network, Stitcher.com, and iTunes. You can find us at occupyradio.org. We've got a return visit this week, Occupiers, from Jerry Monroe Maynard, who is an organizer with Campaign Nonviolence, as well as a music instructor and a lay Catholic minister in Houston, Texas. Jerry, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me back again. I'm really excited to have our conversation today.
Well, you know, Jerry, when we have been looking at the news flashing by our eyes so rapidly in the past couple weeks, one thing that caught my attention, along with the Chapel Hill shootings in North Carolina and rising what we could call Islamophobia in our own country, was a fire that happened in Houston at an Islamic school. And I'm hoping that you can catch us up to speed on both the details, what the people think started the fire now, and also what people in Houston's reaction to this was.
Yeah, the I heard about the fire actually on the television. I had just got home from work, and I turned the TV on, and I saw it on the news, and What happened was it was immediately reported that it was an arson attack, and it was considered to be a hate crime automatically. And as there was some investigation, they found an expectorant in the in the rubbish or whatever, and so there was immediate questions arising. And the part of the building that was under, according to my understanding, the part of the building that was burnt was a storage area. So nobody got hurt. But as some more investigation happened, it came to light that it was a possible homeless person that set the place on fire. And as of right now, that is who officers, I believe, have in custody. Is a homeless man. I have the name somewhere written down, but I do not remember. But the overall response from Houston has been very positive. I actually, when I found out about it, I sent a message to a friend of mine who's a very involved organizer in Houston, and I asked him, was there a safe response, an interfaith response, organized yet? And he said, no. I said, let's organize one. So we started getting connections going, and the imam of the school, which is the name of the imam, is the name of the religious leader for Muslims. I sent him an email, and we organized a press conference, and the press conference was held on the actual spot where the part of the building was burnt. So it helped to give some symbolism that, you know, from the ashes of hate, peace can rise. And the press conference went very well, and the overall response from the community has been very positive and has been very nonviolent in many aspects. So I was very surprised by that, actually.
Now, the perpetrator is a homeless person, and do we know much more about this person? Are there mental health issues or anything like that? Because it always seems like the people who are most easily led to violence by propaganda, negative propaganda especially, are the people who are least stable and least able to process that information. Is that the case here in Houston?
Well, as far as I know, from the report I have in front of me, the homeless man actually did say that it was an accident. So I would assume that he probably is pretty well alert and conscious of his efforts and what he is doing, whatever it is. But, you know, in my own personal opinion, knowing the homelessness situation in Houston, I really don't. This is just my opinion. I don't know all of the facts, but I really don't personally think that the homeless man did the act. I really do think it was an act of Islamophobia, and I think that because homeless people hang around churches and religious organizations in the evening, and this arson event happened like late evening, early morning, I think it's easy to blame them, and I think so. He probably would just happen to be there at the time and might have, you know, taken the bullet for it, I guess. But that's my personal opinion. But no, I don't think he has any mental health issues, but that has not been reported on yet. So we might learn about that in the next coming weeks or so.
I see. So there's a... It's not... you know, we have a bad habit in the United States of assuming guilt until proven innocent, and we see it over and over and over again in the way our news reacts. We saw it with the Boston bomber. The assumption that the suspects were guilty and that all holds were off, you could do anything to those suspects because they were suspected of this crime. I think this mentality in our country is actually leading and hastening a breaking down of respect and justice in our communities. So I'm kind of with you, Jerry, withhold judgment until proof is on the scene. Let's hope that justice is able to provide that, which it so often doesn't, actually. But I wanted to bring up another thing that's been in the news this week, which is a Muslim ring of peace around a synagogue in Oslo, Norway. This happened after a shooting of a synagogue in Copenhagen, Denmark. And that this response cropped up against the rise of anti-Semitism throughout Europe. What's your take on that, Jerry?
Well, you know, what holds Islam and Christianity and Judaism, what holds a common bond between them, you know, is the fact that those three faith traditions are the three predominant monotheistic religions of this world. And I think for a long time, that bond was very strong. And since probably 9/11, maybe even earlier, I think many people have forgotten that connection, have forgotten that relationship that these three different faith traditions have with each other. And I think in the midst of all of this fear and this chaos, people are starting to, you know, try to hold on to one another and try to figure out, you know, with everything going crazy, a lot of times you have to kind of, you know, hold on and kind of grit your teeth and wait for it to pass. And sometimes reaching out to people that we probably normally would not reach out to ends up occurring in situations like this. So I think that the ring around the synagogue is a very powerful image of showing solidarity, showing the willingness to stand up for those who are demonized by many people, especially people of faith. People of faith are usually victims of crimes, or are usually the people that perpetrate crimes. So, you know, I think this symbolic action shows that there can be a balance, you know, in faith. And that people of faith are not extremists, that are not crazy.
Which we like to extend to everybody in the world. You know, the lack of insanity, I hope, is the dominant feature that we all share. And, you know, that the world is actually a much better place than we think, and heading us towards a better place. But we're talking right now with Jerry Monroe Maynard, as I said before, music teacher, Catholic lay minister, and an organizer for Campaign Nonviolence in Houston, Texas. And thanks for touching on these issues with us today, Jerry. This is just the beginning of our look at the push towards violence against Muslims in America. And I'm glad that in this particular instance, we could take a much more positive angle on it. If you got anything else, Jerry, that you'd like to share with our listeners, I'd like to give you the microphone one more time.
Yeah, I just want to leave the listeners with a thought about, you know, there was a story in relation to this that a truck driver who passes through Houston made some comments on social media about his hate for Muslims. And the assistant to this Muslim institute that was set on fire in Houston reached out to him and said, invited him to come to the institute and have a dialogue with him and the other staff members. And after that encounter, this man actually went and made a public apology for his comments because he realized, you know, that Muslim people are not evil, that are not crazy. And so I would really, really strongly suggest that if we have, if you are a listener and you have some type of fear regarding a certain group of people, especially Muslim people, I would encourage you to make an effort to have a dialogue, have an encounter. Because when you encounter somebody, you dignify them and you create a bond where, peace and community can be built. So don't be afraid to get out of your comfort zone and meet people where they are. You'll learn a lot about them.
And I'm sure that Houston is actually learning a lot about how to live together and get along. It's a city with a lot of diverse opinions. And Jerry, we really appreciate that you join us on Occupy Radio to give us an update from your area of this beautiful world that we share.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Find out more about community broadband networks by checking out the website www.muninetworks.org. That's also where you can find out more about the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the other kinds of programs that they run. Now, if you're curious about the things that Jerry Monroe Maynard was talking about, you can friend him on Facebook, or you can also look up www.campaignnonviolence.org.
You're listening to Occupy Radio, which is part of Occupy the Media. And you know, Occupy the Media is the name of a podcast series, but it's also a mission statement.
Because in the age of corporate media, reporting the truth becomes an act of resistance.
Occupy Radio is one of six excellent Occupy and social justice related shows you can find every week at occupythemedia.podomatic.com.
On Sunday, you can listen to All Power to the Positive. Monday is Mic Check Radio. Tuesday, we air Clearing the Fog Radio. Wednesday is Occupy Radio. Thursday, Talk Nation Radio. Friday is Air Occupy. And you can find them all at occupythemedia.podomatic.com.
Occupy the Media!
Occupy Radio is produced through KWVA 88.1 FM on the campus of the University of Oregon. Nathan Stevens is our producer, and we have support from OEMG, the Occupy Eugene Media Group.
Thanks this week to our guests, Christopher Mitchell and Jerry Monroe Maynard, and thanks to my wonderful co-host, Rivera Sun.
It's a big week for the internet occupiers, and we want to know your thoughts on net neutrality and community broadband networks. So give us a line at OccupyRadio23. That's on Twitter and Gmail. We're Occupy Radio on Stitcher and iTunes, where we appreciate your reviews, particularly the five-star ones. You can find us on Facebook on the Occupy Radio group page and chat with us there. And, as always, we are OccupyRadio.org.
For Occupy Radio, I'm David Getchy, Sierra Lupe. As we go to air, occupiers, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler and his fellow commissioners should be voting to regulate the internet under Title II, reclassifying the web as a common carrier and preserving the wide open nature of the net. The next step is to turn back laws restricting community broadband growth in 19 states where laws, often written by internet providers, restrict such growth. Maybe the newly empowered FCC will rule that all communities are free to develop their own high-speed broadband infrastructure by the time we talk to you next week.